I'd like to introduce you to our forum leader and our guest preacher. When our church was founded 150 years ago, there were no Hindu Unitarian Universalists, probably not even 50 years ago, and now there are many, including the Reverend Abhi Janamanchi. Abhi grew up in Andhra Pradesh in southern India. Though trained in physics, he decided to pursue ministry. And though he was a third-generation member of a Hindu reform movement called the Brahmo Samaj, he ended up in Chicago at the young age of 25 to attend a Unitarian Universalist theological seminary there. This is where Abhi and I met on his very first day in town 24 years ago this month. He was an amazing student, reading stacks of books, even as I told him to take it easy. Hence, he graduated with the top prize for academics when commencement came, as well as the prize for religious leadership, and he was ordained in 1998. And since then, he has served congregations in Illinois, Wisconsin, and Florida, and for over 5 years, he has been the senior minister of Cedar Lane UU Church in Bethesda, Maryland, one of our largest congregations. Abhi has served in many volunteer positions for our UU denomination and for social justice and interfaith organizations in Florida and the Washington, D.C. region. He has been president of the International Association for Religious Freedom, an organization that was founded in 1900. As a UU minister of color, Abhi has mentored many colleagues and seminarians in navigating the dominant white culture of our faith tradition. Abhi and his family have been to the White House for two Diwali celebrations, and he was part of a group of Asian American leaders invited to give advice on immigration policy to the president.
Which president?
Let's be clear. All in the prior administration. He wants to be clear. He told Obama he was from Chicago and they fist bumped. Abhi served 3 years on the board of our seminary, completing that about a year ago. And a year ago, the school granted him an honorary doctorate degree. But Abhi's greatest achievement is the beautiful family that he and his wife, Lalitha, have built with two amazing young adult sons. It has been my joy to have been treated like one of the family for all these years. I'm so happy to have a friend with such a deep heart and a minister with such talent and passion to be with us in this beloved community on this day. Welcome, Abhi. And happy to have Jay Nair and Ross Hammond to offer some music for us to get started.
Bhumi Mangalam. Agni Mangalam, Vayu Mangalam, Gagana Mangalam, Surya Mangalam, Chandra Mangalam, Jagat Mangalam, Deha Mangalam, Jiva Mangalam, Mano Mangalam, Atma Mangalam, Sarva Mangalam Bhavadu Bhavadu Bhavatu Sarva Mangalam Bhavadu Bhavadu Bhavatu Sarva Mangalam Bhavadu Bhavadu Bhavatu Bhumi Mangalam, Udaga Mangalam, Agni Mangalam, Vayu Mangalam, Jagana Mangalam, Surya Mangalam, Chandra Mangalam, Jagat Mangalam, Jiva Mangala, Deha Mangalam, Mano Mangalam, Atma Mangalam, Sarva Mangalam, Bhavadu Bhavadu Bhavadu. Bhumi Mangalam, Udaga Mangalam, Agni Mangalam, Vayu Mangalam, Sarva Mangalam, Bhavadu 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 Bhavadu, Sarva Mangalam, Bhavadu Bhavadu Bhavadu.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Awesome. Roger, thank you first for that very generous and kind introduction, glossing over so many wonderful details that make me look so good. Thank you. Roger didn't mention that he was my mentor in seminary in my first year. So we were all assigned a second year student to help us kind of navigate the thistles of seminary education, so to speak, and the brambles as well. But especially for someone just fresh off the plane, so to speak, it was a particular blessing to have Roger kind of companion me through the first year of my life here in the United States, not to mention going to understand what seminary education is all about, having had no clue about what it means to study to be a minister, and having come out of a science background, not knowing what it entails to get through courses that ranged from UU history and theology, and not to mention those nightmarish courses we took at the University of Chicago Divinity School, which still gives me those PTSD moments when I think of. So, thank you. Thank you. And it is truly a joy to be with you today, celebrating your sesquicentennial year of existence in terms of sharing the liberal religious news, the good news of Unitarian Universalism here in the Sacramento area. And I bring warm greetings from your siblings in Cedar Lane, who I think just finished worship, so they must be home now. I guess they are. But they send you warm greetings and celebrate with you on this auspicious occasion. And especially, from one capital region to another, we say to you, thank you for not only flying the flag of resistance, but really, really thumbing your nose in so many wonderful ways. Bless you. Now, I could go completely off tangent and spend the next 20 minutes on that topic, but given that I had committed myself in a momentary phase of foolishness of daring to say to Roger that I would, in 20 minutes or less, encapsulate for you almost 4,000 years of history of this amazing religious tradition that is loosely called Hinduism. So here we go. I'm stuck, after all. Now, the reason I wanted to share something about the Hindu tradition was not just because I identify as a Unitarian Universalist Hindu. It's more because of the deep connection that has existed between Unitarian Universalism and the Hindu tradition for almost 200 years, dating back to the early 1800s, when there was a robust correspondence happening between the likes of William Ellery Channing, Henry Ware Sr., with Ram Mohan Roy, who was the founder of the Unitarian Hindu Reform Movement, the Brahma Samaj, the Society of the Worshippers of One God, the movement to which I belong to. I'm a third generation member of the Brahma Samaj, in which they were discussing not just theological issues, because Ram Mohan Roy identified with Unitarian Christianity and wrote an amazing treatise called The Precepts of Jesus, similar to the Jefferson Bible, in 1825. And also, Channing and Henry Ware were particularly concerned that Ram Mohan Roy, who they considered to be a Hindu heathen, would not convert to Unitarianism, feeling that that was the path to salvation. And Roy, in a not-so-subtle way, schooling Channing in helping him understand that one doesn't have to convert to Unitarianism in order to appreciate the deeper principles of the Unitarian faith, that he was deeply happy as to who he was as a Hindu. So that was the first connection between American Unitarianism and the Hindu tradition in India, which 50 years later was expanded upon in a more deeper, richer way by Emerson and Thoreau and members of the Transcendentalist movement. You know, that beautiful hymn that we sang, Longfellow's poem, is actually a celebration of the Transcendentalist ideas of how nature, all of creation, is imbued with the divine, a deeply Hindu idea. And then another 50 years later, Swami Vivekananda, who came to the United States to speak at the Parliament of World Religions in 1893 in Chicago, was invited into Unitarian homes and congregations, including right here in Oakland and San Francisco, though he didn't make it to Sacramento. There, these ties were not only forged, but strengthened. So it is meaningful for us to be engaging with this ancient yet living tradition that is called Hinduism. And take a closer look. The third largest religion in the world today, with nearly a billion adherents, most of whom live in India and Nepal. There are approximately 1.3 million Hindus of Indian origin who live in the US today. So the question is, what is Hinduism? But it is a problematic question because the word Hindu was first used by the Persians in 6th century BCE and later the Greeks to denote the people who lived nearby and beyond the river Sindhu or Indus. And then Muslim rulers who invaded northern India in the 8th century appropriated the term and used it to differentiate their Muslim subjects from their non-Muslim subjects. And it was from this abstraction in the 19th century that the colonial British, bless their hearts, coined the term Hinduism to refer to a supposed religious system that encompassed the beliefs and practices of Indian peoples not following Islam, Christianity, or Jainism. So basically, they lumped everyone who were not Christian, Muslim, or Jain into Hinduism. So you wonder how the Sikhs must have felt about that. Since then, the notion of Hinduism has suggested a coherent religion to be found all over India and around the world, even though many Hindus prefer the term Sanatan Dharma, immemorial or eternal tradition. But Hinduism is not a religion in the Western religious sense. So if you walked in this morning with that box in your mind and trying to figure out a way to place this tradition in that box, I invite you now to fold that box and put it away. It's not going to fit. So there's no point in your trying to. For instance, the Hindu tradition has no spiritual founder like the Buddha or Confucius or Jesus or the Prophet Muhammad. It has no single religious text like the Holy Quran or the Torah or the Bible. In fact, it draws from many sacred texts, the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, to name a few. It has not one creation story, but multiple creation stories about how the universe and life came into being. It does not have a single overarching institutional or ecclesiastical hierarchy like the Pope, capable of deciding questions of religious boundary or formulating standards of doctrine and practice. And it does not require its adherents to believe in or subscribe to a set of beliefs or creeds or dogma like the Ten Commandments or the Five Pillars of Islam or the Nicene Creed or not even the Seven Principles of Unitarian Universalism. I was talking to my friends this morning over coffee as to what it is that they cherish about the Hindu tradition. And the word that my friend used was freedom. You have the freedom to be who you want to be within the Hindu tradition. There is no prescribed way of being Hindu. So the Hindu tradition at its best is a complex and dynamic pattern of life and practice, a way of life. It is a complex social system and an elaborately articulated spiritual sensibility. So given such tremendous diversity, one might wonder if there is an anchor for this floating mass of diverse beliefs and practices, rituals and customs that the Hindu tradition seems to hold and encompass. Now, in this regard, Hindu scholar Arvind Sharma likens the Hindu tradition to one of our favorite foods, a donut. He says, it is the donut that defines the donut hole. Right? It is the donut that defines the donut hole and not the other way around. Keep that in mind as you try to figure out Hinduism. So while the Hindu tradition may be difficult to define in theoretical terms, its contribution to the spiritual heritage of humanity is not in doubt. Hindus, like the followers of any other religion, worship, pray, work, and seek well-being in this world, in this life, as well as the next, and the next, and the next, for themselves and their families and their friends. You see, we believe in being born again and again and again and again. It goes on. Now, many of them believe that every living being goes through a continuous cycle of birth, death, and rebirth called samsara, a dilemma that is brought about by the consequences of one's actions, karma, which determines what or who we will be in our future lives. So work hard, do your duty, give 10% to the UU Society of Sacramento, practice compassion, and your next life will be better than this one. Live hedonistically, selfishly, wickedly, lie and expect to be reborn in poorer circumstances. So it is assured that Trump will be reborn a mosquito in his next life. Hold that thought. Isn't that good? Okay. So while I am a practicing Hindu, I want to clarify I'm not a pacifist. So karma is, in a sense, the law of nature. Universal, because it applies to all of nature, but finite, because nature itself is finite. Ultimately, the aim as it's expounded in the Hindu tradition, is to be free from repeated life cycles by engaging in spiritual practices. So for Hindus, reincarnation is not a good thing, as some New Age movements lead us to believe here. It is actually to be rid of having to be born again and again. And how do we get to that place of being in communion with the divine, the ground of our being? Many Hindus hold that there are four goals in life. They're not sequential, nor arbitrary, nor hierarchical. There are just four goals that one can pursue. Number one is kama, the pursuit of pleasure. As long as the basic rules of morality are observed, one is free to seek all the pleasure they want. Second comes artha, the pursuit of wealth or material success, which is a requisite for supporting one's family and honoring one's civic commitments. The third is dharma. Dharma means many things, but its underlying meaning is that which supports. In a larger sense, dharma means the essential order of things, and integrity and harmony in the universe and the affairs of life. Thus, dharma also means justice, righteousness, and goodness. The final goal is moksha, liberation. Liberation from suffering, from attachment to worldly pleasures and desires, to our ego, all of that. In a way that we feel liberated and at one with all that is. And there are different spiritual paths or yoga that gets one on the path to liberation, to moksha. There's the path of action, again, karma yoga, which entails unselfish action that is fulfilling one's duty without expecting praise or blame. Then is the path of knowledge, jnana yoga, which is constituted by attaining spiritual knowledge and by this gain true insight into the real nature of the universe. Then there's the path of devotion, bhakti yoga. We experienced that with Jay's beautiful music this morning, which outlines as means for final liberation of the surrender to and wholehearted trust in the divine principle. And then there is the Raja Yoga, the fourth path, which is more of an integral form of yoga that invites us to actually carry forth all three of these in order to cleanse and purify mind, body, and spirit. But the fundamental teaching of the Hindu tradition, if there is one, is that a human being's basic nature is not confined to their body or mind. That it is beyond both of these, in that the spark of divinity, the Atman, resides not just in every human being, but in everything in the universe. That the universe is shot through with the divine. And in that, we carry the spark of divinity within each and all of us, including Donald Trump. No, seriously. So, when we say namaste, it roughly translates to I bow to the divine in you. It means I see you, the essential you. There's a word in Sanskrit for that. It is called darshan. So when we go to temple, we don't go to pray. We don't go to worship. We go for darshan. Darshan means to see and to be seen by the divine. And that's what we mean when we say namaste. What a beautiful principle. So the essential teaching of the Hindu tradition is we are all original blessings, endowed with original goodness, no exceptions. So Hindus believe in the inherent worth, dignity, and divinity of every human being. I think we're done. That's basically the one big thing. But the question is, if we're all infinite in our being, and if we're all manifestations of the divine, in that sense, if we're all God, aham brahmasmi, why don't we realize this, let alone practice it? Well, the answer lies in the depth at which the eternal is buried within us, camouflaged by distractions, delusions, and self-serving instincts, maya, which is not just illusion. It is the illusion that we carry that what we see, feel, experience, crave for is actually real. That's maya. And our task is to cleanse our lives, to allow the light that is within to fully radiate, and to understand this basic unity of Brahman and Atman, the eternal consciousness and the individual consciousness. The Chandogya Upanishad explains this unity in a conversation between a sage and his son. The father asks the son to dissolve salt in water and says that Brahman and Atman are united in a similar manner. He ends his teaching in explaining the finest essence here that constitutes the self of this world. That is the truth. That is the self, and that thou art. Tatvam asi. So the Hindu tradition takes differences of approach and belief into account by allowing people a remarkably free hand in choosing the kind of God they might want to worship, and in the spiritual method they might consider appropriate for each worship. Which is brings us to the topic of image worship, and the accommodation provided to atheists amidst all this is also a further recognition of the role diversity, theological diversity, plays in the Hindu tradition, something again that we can connect with as Unitarian Universalists. So in Hinduism, the concept of the chosen people is turned around into the choosing people. That is, Hindus choose the gods they want to worship or don't want to worship. For instance, some may choose to worship God in a male form, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, Rama. Some as female, Devi, Shakti, Kali, Saraswati, Lakshmi. Some as a small child, Krishna. Some as a monkey, Hanuman. Some as an elephant, Ganesha. Or as a man lion, Narasimha. And some may choose not to worship God as an image, like the members of the Brahma Samaj do, Nirguna Brahman, God without attributes. The Rig Veda proclaimed more than 3,500 years ago, Ekam Sat Vipra Bahuda Vadanti. Truth is one, the wise ones call it by many names. So, this again is the plurality of religious expression that invites people into deeper relationship with that ultimate mystery that we, some of us, name God. But what we have is a faith tradition that allows each believer to reach out and be in communion with their notion of the divine or holy, to follow their bliss and yet be in active communion with one another, with the world, with all of creation. So what I love about the Hindu tradition is this kind of diversity, the lack of compulsion, and the tremendous richness of the various ways it's practiced universally. I have deep regard for the millennia-old tradition of inclusiveness that made Hindu societies open their arms wide to people of every faith to come and practice their faith in peace among Hindus. At the same time, I am deeply mindful that while Hinduism as a faith might privilege inclusiveness, this does not necessarily mean that all Hindus practice it. So though I am proud that I am a Hindu, I am not proud of some things Hindu. I'm not proud of Hindus attacking Muslim and Christian places of worship, raping Christian women, or lynching Muslim men. I'm not proud of Hindu vegetarians who have roasted people alive and rejoiced over their corpses. I'm not proud of those who reduce the soaring majesty of the Vedas to their own petty bigotry and use it to exclude others or kill and brutalize people in the name of a benevolent god, Rama. I'm outraged by the centuries-old oppression that the caste system has wrought on people's lives, our version of white supremacy culture, just to kind of give you some context, diminished their sense of self-worth and dignity, and created and sustained a permanent social underclass. But I'm still glad to be a part of a faith whose rituals and customs I am free to reject and that does not force me to demonstrate my allegiance by any visible sign, by subsuming my identity in any form of collectivity, not even by a specific day or time or frequency of worship, which is why I continue to be a practicing Hindu. Then why on earth am I a Unitarian Universalist? I've asked myself that question. You see, first of all, my Hindu faith leaves me plenty of room to be a Unitarian Universalist. That's why I'm a UU Hindu, not a Hindu UU. My Hindu came first, and it'll be the last as well. But I'm a Unitarian Universalist because it helps me to be a better Hindu. It is my Unitarian Universalism that helps me sift through my Hindu baggage, keeping what is meaningful and necessary and throwing out all that is life-negating. It is because of my Unitarian Universalism that I now have the courage both of my convictions and my confusions. Unitarian Universalism gives me courage to rise up for what I believe in, even when it's not popular, and not quit when the going gets tough. It supports my multi-hyphenated identity as a theological crossbreed, a spiritual mutt, a religious hybrid. To be able to live and move with integrity in those interstitial spaces, the hyphenated places between all those identities. So as a UU Hindu, I am proud to be part of two religious traditions that do not claim to be the one true religion. So, I could go on, but I realize we are getting to a close here. So I want to conclude with the words of someone I consider to be one of the greatest Hindus of the 20th century, Mahatma Gandhi. Because what he has to say in many ways encapsulates how I feel as well as how it applies to us as Unitarian Universalists. Gandhiji wrote, "After long study and experience, I have come to the conclusion that all religions are true. All religions have some error in them, and all religions are as dear to me as my own Hinduism, in as much as all human beings should be as dear to one as one's own close relatives. My own veneration for other faiths is the same as that for my own faith. I do not want my house to be walled on all sides and my windows to be stuffed. I want the cultures of all lands to be blown about my house as freely as possible. But I refuse to be blown off my feet by any. Mine is not a religion of the prison house. Ours is not a religion of the prison house. So may we let all doors and windows be open in our minds, hearts, spirits, and in our spiritual home in ways that enliven, embolden, and enrich our living together. So may it be. Amen."